You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show. And I have monopolized today's guest. I have arranged this at a time when Brian couldn't make it so that I could have him all to myself. Dacher Keltner, a long time. I don't know if he's a fan of the show, but we're certainly a fan of him.
And yeah, I am Hunter.
So. Good, good. And today we are talking about Dacher's latest book, The Power Paradox. Which, you know, I mean, it's always timely to talk about power and the different kinds of power and how people acquire power. But yeah. Given the 2016 U.S. presidential election, it's extra timely. So, Dacher, tell us about this book. I mean, you've been studying power for a long time. And what have you found?
So, you know, I've been studying power for 20 years, as you know, Hunter, and the book really centers on a few ideas, which is what is power? And mm-hmm. I think it really, in our 21st century, is really about stirring the minds and ideas of broad social collectives. And that's an idea that Hannah Arendt and Michel Foucault and a lot of other people wrote about. And then the book really centers on this paradox, which is, you know, how do we get power? And we tend to get power through really uniting people and stirring ideas in their minds that impassion them, right? And paradoxically, in today's, I think when you look at the data from the election, the recent election, it does tend to speak to this, which is Trump did something that stirred people unexpectedly, and Hillary failed to do that in certain ways. And then regrettably, the paradox comes in, which is, you know, we get power by kind of stirring the passions with promise of serving their interests of many. And then once we get power, we become really narrow and really self-interested and impulsive and unethical very often. So it's that paradoxical quality that we see so often in history with respect to power.
Well, and I remember the last time you were on the show, we talked about Lord Acton's famous saying that, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think probably between when you were on and when we since now, you know, I took a look at the origins of that, and it's actually from the time when the Catholic Church was planning to make papal infallibility official doctrine.
And
here's a guy who, you know, is a dyed-in-the-wool Catholic, and he's like, yeah, I'm a big Catholic, I'm a big believer in the Church, but at the same time, humans. I mean, you know, all humans, you know, they just power messes them up. And that is what the research finds, right?
Yeah. Hunter, I always appreciate how deep you go. And, you know, Lord Acton was looking at the Catholic Church and, you know, and seeing the kinds of things that we see in religious institutions of abuse and, you know, self-serving economic interests. And he said, wow, even these people committed to the sacred life are prone to abusing power. And our studies show that, you know, we're all vulnerable to this corrupting influence of power. So if you give someone power, they become less empathetic. They read people's emotions less effectively. They respond when they are presented images of kids with cancer. they don't respond with as much compassion.
Right.
And then that diminishing of these moral sentiments leads them to hoard resources, drive like, I won't use the word on air, but, you know, drive in offensive ways, do a lot of.
And by the way, on this show, I mean, you know, we've set the bar so low that it's going to be very hard for you to limbo underneath the bar of acceptable behavior and language.
So it's, we're all vulnerable.
Yeah, we're all vulnerable. And I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, you know, Tul Gawande had that great commencement speech that he gave at Caltech about the mistrust of science. And a large part of what he's talking about there is his personal journey from being an arrogant little shit to actually becoming a mature individual. And, you know, he has this great line in there that the scientific mind is an experimental one, not a litigious one.
Yeah.
And that's definitely the transformation that I've gone through personally, where as a young man, I, you know, emerged from Harvard with a biochemistry degree and I was like, I'm so smart. I know all these things. And then you go around and you try and find faults in other people's thinking. And then, you know, I had this profound experience of moving out to LA and suddenly being surrounded by actors, and all actors talk about all the time are their feelings. And, you know, I mean, I was a rationalist, and I was like, oh, reason and emotion are separate, and reason is good and emotion is bad. And it was super annoying that all they talked about all day was their feelings. And so at a certain point, I had this moment in acting class where I got so frustrated with them talking about feelings. I'm like, this is silly superstition. You guys don't even know what you're talking about. I'm going to go look at the scientific literature. And so I did, and I went and read Kahneman and Damasio and Haidt and, you know, all your work, and Seligman and Dweck and all of the great thinkers of my belief system, and found out that I didn't know shit. And that I'd fallen for this idea of Descartes' error, what Damasio talks about, that thinking and feeling are separate, and really they're not. And, you know, I think that there's a... that I think, it, you know, in terms of the scientific community, of which I am a peasant and you are a high priest, you know, I think we really have to make it clear that to be a scientist, you have to essentially follow the golden rule.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. And you know, in the scientific community, you know, as you know, we're having these various humbling crises, right? How well do our findings replicate? We've had a couple of instances of people, you know, manipulating data. I will say the level of unethical behavior is low relative to other kinds of industries. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and we're in this period where I hope that we adopt your stance, which is to take a humble approach to kind of the system of knowledge that we're trying to create. And we make mistakes, very human, emotional mistakes.
Right.
But at the same time, there's opportunity for refinement.
And I think, part of it, I think, too, that, in your book, as I read your book, I kept on having these thoughts about Joe Henrich's The Secret of Our Success.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Joe talks about there is the distinction between two kinds of power systems that human have, dominance and prestige. Yeah. And it felt like that's a lot of what you were talking about, but that you, being a great science communicator, were like, let's not use the technical jargon.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that what Joe's worked on and our lab and people are starting to think about is, and this comes out of, in a way, the game theoretic tradition of there's cooperation and competition as these basic strategies. And you even see this, you know, I talk about this in the power paradox in the studies of power and our hunter-gatherer predecessors, which are these two strategies mm-hmm. by which we gain power, right? We can dominate and be coercive. And the best representative that I critique is Machiavelli. Mm-hmm. Or we can gain status and prestige in Joe's terms, or we can be in get practice collaborative power and virtuous power, which Aristotle was really interested in. And really we can look at our own relationships with our loved ones. We can look at today's political sort of situation in those terms of where are we in this struggle between the more collaborative and coercive models. And I think it's really useful to think in that way.
And I think, I think part of it too, though, is that technology has changed the kind of power that is rewarded. And
interesting.
And I think the point is that in this environment, right, in general, you know, you obviously, like, Trump, to many liberals, comes off as a bully, and he is a bully. But at the same time, you know, I have relatives who live in Kansas.
Sure.
And for a long time, they have felt that, you know, the sort of the liberal community and the academic community has condescended to them. And so, you know, I mean, I had the experience of moving out here and tutoring to pay my bills, and taught some kids at a Christian school that was set up specifically to teach the controversy, right, around evolution, right? And I mean, it's very interesting because, you know, this all fits together with John Haidt's work, because in practice, what I think people don't realize is that if you're in sort of a secular school, what you're really resting on is you're resting on intuitions of authority about science. Like, there's about half the country that's like, oh, scientists know what they're talking about. And so, you know, they can listen. When you go into a Christian school, you're in the opposite environment, where not only is science not only an authority, but, you know, the well has been poisoned so much that you don't have any sort of relationship and you can't rely on that. And so actually teaching the controversy to people who are set out to think, oh, you guys are arrogant shits. You think you know it all. Like, you've insulted my faith for 150 years. Why should I listen to you? It's an entirely different emotional environment, and you're really fighting an uphill battle. And that's why, personally, I think that it's time that science ended its holy war.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear you. You know, I think, I mean, I've had a couple of encounters with this, you know, how I talk about it is like different ways of knowing, right? Mm-hmm. These are different epistemologies of mm-hmm. thinking about what truth is, where it comes from, and how it maps onto the what we perceive to be the facts of the world. And I do feel that, you know, that we will be more productive by cultivating a more respectful discourse, right?
Yeah.
At UC Berkeley, in my Science of Happiness class, and they get a lot of science and a lot of statistics and scientific principles of inference and data and so forth. And I teach religion. And this is a pretty secular group, mm-hmm. obviously progressive, but we do know a religious practice gives people happiness. It gives mm-hmm. people, it actually boosts life expectancy. We yep. don't know why. And those facts are just part of what we have to grapple with, that they're different ways of approaching the world that have different traditions behind them, and they deserve respect.
Right. And I think the interesting thing, too, is that, you know, I think part of what people don't realize in the age of social media, and where the analogy yeah. that I draw to it is that it's very much like the analogy that that Steven Pinker talks about in The Better Angels of Our Nature, where yeah. you have dueling, and for, you know, that's a cultural practice that goes on for a really, really long time. And then all of a sudden the gun shows up, and suddenly fighting to first blood is a very different thing. It's a much more deadly thing. And so yeah. you end up with people like, you know, Hamilton, who is clearly a very smart dude, but just sort of goes into this duel thing and, you know, lets someone shoot at him, which is yeah. not particularly wise.
Yeah.
And they're essentially, that is the better angels of our nature. We're forced to become much more compassionate and much more civilized by the technology. And yeah. that's essentially the I've had this experience, because having a Facebook feed that is sort of purple, right, because yeah. of family and then because of college friends and all that sort of stuff, it's really tempting. You know, you can post memes that, you know, are going to like play really well to one side of the aisle, and everyone's going to think it's really funny. But the problem is that there's an externality there, and that same joke that is funny to you is like just creates more bipartisanship and more political divisiveness on the other side.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that's one of, you know, I think we're all searching right now, like, what are going forward? What are the productive things we can do out of this pretty egregious election? You
right.
know, I have two teenage daughters who, you know, this is hard on them. For various reasons. And one of them is this productive civil discourse that mm-hmm. we've always championed in this culture, and really to engage in that effectively. I think the new social media dimension to not only this election, but to power more generally, right?
Right.
It has this enormous force for disseminating information, but truth. You know, Facebook's going to really have to grapple with how they calculate or parameterize what should be transmitted. Should it be upheld to ethical and truth standards, right? Or is it just likes? And I think there are going to be serious questions coming out of this.
Well, and you consult for Facebook, don't you?
I do help out there from time to time.
So you may be having this exact conversation with Mark.
I don't have this conversation.
Listen, Zuck, let's sit down. Let's have a chat.
Mark, I need some of your time.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I'll be down there on Thursday.
Yeah. Well,
can you fit into my schedule?
Yeah. Listen, I mean, if I was Mark Zuckerberg and you called me yeah. up and said Thursday, I'd be like, sure, whatever you need, Dacher. But, you know, I'm not Mark.
You're too nice, Hunter. Yeah, I think they have to, you know, and this election has brought out all these interesting bubbles, hasn't mm-hmm. it? Right. Who are those, you know, why do the polls get it wrong? Mm-hmm. How do we think about, you know, what's transmitted on Facebook? And Facebook, to a certain extent, is a very profound bubble. It's a small organization in a way.
Yep.
And they got to think hard about, you know, the transmission of information. And then, you know, who are the people? I grew up around poor white people in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I love those people.
Right.
But I understand why they voted for Trump, and they have
yeah.
their flaws like all of us. And so we got to engage in more understanding.
Where did you grow up?
Well, you know, Hunter, I had the most wild As I've gotten older, I realize, and in raising kids, how unusual this is. My mom got her PhD at UCLA, and we lived in Laurel Canyon. You may know Laurel Canyon.
I know Laurel Canyon very well. I've driven it many times.
Well, in 1970, it had model schools. It was a phenomenal neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, it was where you want your kids to grow up. And my mom got a teaching job at Sacramento State University. And we moved to the foothills of the Sierras, mm-hmm. a small town called Penryn, mm-hmm. which at the time was like, it was dirt poor. It was like Appalachia. And I lived amongst people who were Trump supporters.
Yeah.
Which was a great education for my brother.
Well, I think that's fundamentally, one of the interesting things from Haidt's happiness hypothesis is just the degree to which it really is so much easier to see the splinter in your brother's eye than the log in your own. and so much so that I really think that, like, the only way that you can see your cultural biases is to leave your culture. I think that, because for me, it was, you know, I had this sort of cultural bias towards this mythical idea of reason. And, you know, while in, you know, the social sciences and psychology, you know, you guys may have moved past that idea. I will tell you that in sort of adjacent academic fields like biochemistry, it is alive and well. They really believe in Descartes' error. You know,
especially at Harvard University.
Oh, 100%. The level, I mean, you know, and the way that I've come to think about this is that, you know, we became so intensely interested in the outside world that we forgot to know thyself. Like commandment number one in the path to wisdom. And so, you know, I mean, the problem with all of that is that, you know, it really wasn't until I left that culture and was forced to move and spend time among the most emotional group of people, actors, that I had to, like, correct for that. And then it wasn't until I spent time among Christians and, you know, in that sort of environment that you then start to see, oh, wait, there are problems in our community. We're not necessarily living up to our own principles. And also fundamentally, you know, maybe some of us aren't that wise and aren't such a great representation of our belief system.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and what a transformation. I hope you write about it someday, to go from the rationalism of Harvard to, you know, the ancient passions of a Christian community. Yeah. I've had the same experience where in many different times in my life, you know, now I, you know, it's incredible, Hunter. I do this work with the Sierra Club, getting veterans outdoors, and mm-hmm. I work with a lot of veterans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where I went to grad school at Stanford, I think there are two or three veterans on campus, right? Mm-hmm. You can ask people in many circles, do you know the veteran community? And they don't know them, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a couple million people in America who really fundamentally should be part of our broader conversation. And so I think what I like about what John Haidt is advocating for too, and it's great you bring up his work, is in this moment, we need to engage in conversations with multiple communities.
Yep.
And no more pressing time.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing too, is in terms of chapter 2 of your book, Power is Given, Not Grabbed. Yeah. So talk more about that. How does that work?
Well, in a way this comes out. So, you know, when we evolved as John Haidt, Joseph Henrich, people you've mentioned, Franz de Waal, E.O. Wilson, into a hyper-social species, mm-hmm. we developed a capacity to form alliances and become social networks. And that suddenly shifts power dynamics when you compare hominids to our primate relatives, such that power becomes something that social collectives grant to individuals, mm-hmm. right? And then added to that is work by Cameron Anderson and my lab and elsewhere, that the social collectives they're looking to individuals who will do things that will advance their welfare, their self-interest. So we end up with this principle that power goes to people who have the promise of advancing the interests of the broadest social collective.
Right.
And so it's given, it's not really grabbed. You know, right now liberals feel like Trump grabbed the election, but it's a different story really, I think, when the facts will settle, that he stirred a sense of the future, that where those people feel like there's an opportunity for improvement.
Right. And I think crucially, I mean, you know, to sort of tie all of this together, there's, you know, a book that is massively underread, I think, is Everett Rogers, The Diffusion of Innovations. And one of the big points. It's amazing. It's worth a read because it's sort of like it's the best case, I think, for why scientific writing needs to reform, because it's a book all about how ideas actually move. That was written in 1967, and so it is an idea that did not diffuse because it is written in that super dry technical style that has become the hallmark of scientific writing. So within the scientific community, there are these like sort of rumblings of like, some of this writing's bad. And it's like, well, it's so bad. Like there's your proof of how bad it is. It is literally like the test case of like a book that did not practice what it preached. A lot of what it's talking about is that in order for ideas to move, they have to be a good fit for the existing culture. So he gives the story of some healthcare workers who are in some remote Andean village, and they're trying to convince women to boil their water right before drinking it. And it's a very simple idea, but there are a lot, you know, when you really break it down and you think about it from the perspective of the local women, there are a huge number of problems. Yeah. Firstly, you know, talking about, there are these invisible creatures you can't see in your water, but if you boil the water and then you let it cool down, they'll be magically gone. I mean, it sounds quite literally nuts, and you can't rely on the intuitions of authority about science. So there's that problem, right?
Yeah.
And then separately, there was already in the culture an existing belief about water, boiled water, and essentially that there it's sort of that sympathetic medicine, hot food, cold food type thing. So that sort of practice was already associated with being for people who were sick. So it wasn't for healthy people. So why would healthy people do a thing that was for sick people? And, you know, I mean, again, this is this intuitionist thinking, and it really fundamentally, in order to move ideas, you have to be incredibly empathetic. And that is, you know, I think that is not a thing that science is famous for. As an institution, as it currently stands, it's more famous for just sort of speaking its truth and then being like, why don't you idiots get it?
Yeah, you know, although I would push back a little, because one of the great things in reading The Power Paradox or writing The Power Paradox is just studying the lives of people who have made huge differences in the world. And what they do have is what you're talking about is this way of and this applies to scientists, too, of like looking at what is happening in, you know, ecological systems or social systems. And finding an idea that makes sense of it all, which is an act of empathy in a way.
Outward. Huge.
And Darwin was the great example of that, right?
Right.
He hung out. He got a lot of his ideas. So interesting from talking to working class pigeon breeders, right? Most scientists of the day would never cavort with working class individuals. Darwin was there, and he's like, these guys have so much knowledge from their daily work that it shaped this most influential theory. So great science probably is rooted in empathy.
Well, I think that's,
ordinary science might not be.
I think that's the point. Great science is 100%. But I think that, you know, one of often on, you know, social media or whatever, you'll see a lot of sort of young scientists, and they'll be like, because science, right? Which is the America of the scientific community. And it shows a total lack of understanding of just how complex and diverse the actual scientific community is. And that, you know, if you want, you can go and find a scientist who will reinforce all your worst prejudices. And if you want, you can go and find someone who, you know, really is reflective and thoughtful. And those are the people that we generally enjoy having on this show, like you. And so I think that's the thing is that, you know, what I'm talking about is that distinction between, you know, science is not a homogenous organization. It is not an organization where there is broad doctrinal agreement. You know, there's a real diversity of thought. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the scientists who are most empathetic do a lot of the best work. I think that that's a requirement.
Yeah, no, and I think this is, and science, you know, real science requires humility, right? If we're really committed to the principle of falsification, of Kuhn and Lakathos and others, we really need to be ready to disprove our core notions.
Right.
And that's the, in a way, the engine of the scientific enterprise.
That's right. That's right. The willingness to be wrong.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, to get back to the idea of power and chapter four of your book, Abuses of Power.
Yeah.
You know, I after high school, I had the opportunity to go work at Cold Spring Harbor for a year. And I lived in the house of Jim Watson of Watson and Crick.
Yeah. And wow.
That was a really interesting experience because, you know, the old saying, you should never meet your hero. Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, you know, I idolized Jim. Like, to me, Jim was what it was all about as a young man because, you know, Jim had made this huge epoch-making discovery. And, I mean, talk about making your mark. I mean, it's, I mean, you know, it's incredible. And to be fair, you know, much like, you know, we often as young people hold our fathers or our mothers to ridiculously high standards that they could never live up to, you know, my expectations of Jim were very off. And then the reality was very different from what I expected Jim to be. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's interesting is I've spent a lot of time thinking about Jim's fall from grace, which for listeners who don't know, Jim has for a very long time been saying things that were controversial. And then essentially a few years ago, he said some things that he didn't think there was much hope or promise for Africa because essentially all the studies show that they don't have the same intellectual potential. And anyone who has had to work with black workers knows this, which is as a huge abuse of power because Jim is the co-discoverer of DNA. Yeah. And to someone outside the scientific community, it can seem like, oh, the guy who discovered DNA are saying black people just aren't as smart, then it must be true. But, you know, and the scientific community rightly, you know, he was stripped of his post and, you know, he's been in disgrace essentially ever since.
Wow.
But, you know, I mean, that's sort of the problem is that Jim earned power by doing good work.
Yeah.
You know, the double helix was huge work. You know, he founded the Harvard Biochemistry Department. The double helix is one of the best works ever written, I think, on, you know, what does science actually look like? And it's very entertaining and all of this sort of stuff. But, you know, I mean, with great power comes great responsibility. And if you don't use that power responsibly, then it is stripped from you.
You know, it's stunning to me, you know, and science offers up regular examples like this where, you know, the people who really change fields and make groundbreaking discoveries, they're vulnerable to the very simplifying of thought that is part of the abuse of power, you know, and I didn't know that story, Hunter. It's terrific. And you see this all over the place. You know, you see it in just about every discipline. And I think that it's actually, I was talking to a junior colleague of mine at Berkeley about how this is actually a very interesting dynamic in the evolution of science, which is that it's really the younger people who have the more careful thoughts and the more wide open thinking and the paradigm shifting insights. And then along, and that's how we rise, right?
Yeah.
And then along comes the power paradox, which is you get your awards, your salary rises, people are citing you, they direct their respect to you, and your edge is just not as sharp. And
right.
So you fall from grace in more dramatic terms.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because, I mean, for me, it was always a real study in contrast was Jim Watson and Francis Crick because, you know, and a lot of it came down to work. You know, Jim rested on his laurels in many senses. And, you know, having spent a year with the man and brunched with him and done all of these sorts of things. And to be clear, like, he was very kind to me and, you know, I mean, gave me a tremendous opportunity and I'm extremely grateful to him. But, you know, and I think Jim said afterwards, you know, I'm not racist in a conventional sense. And in reality, you know, and people were like, well, you said this. But I think they don't sort of understand the psychology of Jim. And the psychology of Jim is that Jim has always had an eye for what was attention grabbing. And that was the source of his greatest success. He knew that the double helix was going to be this big epoch-making thing and that, you know, he was going to be able to dine out on it because it was a great symbol and all that sort of stuff. But that same psychological drive was the one that has caused him to say these things. And, it, yeah. you know, I mean, for 50 years, he'd been trying to get a rise out of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the circumstances aligned and he got a much bigger rise out of people than he was expecting, I think. But, you know, Francis Crick went back to work. He discovered the double helix, and then he did all of the work on translation and all that sort of stuff. And he was working until the day he died. And I think there's a real liberation that comes from that work, rather than, you know, human beings aren't supposed to sit around idle. It's unhealthy, I think.
Yeah, can I just, it's so interesting what you're saying, Hunter, and what a terrific example. You know, one of the dimensions to the power paradox that I write about in the power paradox is as we rise in power and when we're really at the top of our game, mm-hmm. we become convinced in our minds that we're successful because of kind of inherent special brilliances. And we don't need to work because we got the special IQ or the special gene or whatever it is. And that leads us astray because it makes us forget all the hard work we put into rising and how essential it is to great work, to success. You know, when I got to work on Inside Out, which was one of the great privileges of my life, because I study human emotion, which we talked about last time with you. And I remember working with Pete Docter, who's the director, for 5 years on that film. And that guy worked hard mm-hmm. with Ronnie Harmon. And he won the Academy Award. He won the British Award. It was a really massively successful film. And I remember having a beer with him. And I was like, man, you know, you must be feeling, this must be amazing. And he's like, I made some mistakes in that film. And let me tell you about my next film. Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, literally a week after he's digging into work.
Right.
And that's a good reminder.
Well, do you know the origins of Arbeit macht frei?
No.
So it's actually, this was the famous phrase that was on the gate at Auschwitz. But it actually originally comes from a novel that was written, I can't remember, 50, 60 years before, about a guy who was a gambler and an alcoholic and a dissolute. And essentially, work was what saved him. You know, it was going back to work and working hard that freed him. But then, of course, the Nazis, you know, took this thing that was actually a beautiful principle about, you know, human psychology and sort of how to have a better and happier life. And they put it in this context that suddenly made it disgusting.
Wow.
One of the best things I've ever read was I haven't been able to ever find it again. You know, sometimes you read something, you're like, that's amazing. Where is it? But it was an intro to one of Primo Levi's books. And he said that, you know, one of the worst things about the Holocaust for him, because he was a chemist, was that it robbed work of its dignity and that work was never the same for him. And, you know, I mean, he ultimately ended up committing suicide. So, you know, I mean, that idea of work as this very sort of liberating concept and this thing that is key to psychological health and happiness, I think is the thing that is massively, it's underestimated.
Yeah, absolutely. And a critical question for today.
Yeah, I think so, especially because robots are going to take all our jobs. And so, you know, that's part of the interesting thing. I mean, we've talked on this show before about, you know, Daniel Pink has this great sort of schema for making sense of different human motivations. You know, he says Drive 1.0 was, you know, the Leviathan. I'm going to scare the shit out of you and you're going to do what I say. It's that very sort of dominant style of power. Drive 2.0 is capitalism. You know, it's all about self-interest and all that sort of stuff. And now essentially what he's saying, and I 100% agree, is that we now need to move to Drive 3.0, which is, you know, what he calls autonomy, mastery, and purpose, the sort of intrinsic desire to do great things and do great work so that we all become like Jiro and Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
No, I think that, you know, when you look at the data on the millennials, they and you look at the direction of our economy, we're shifting out of old capitalist models and we do have to reconceptualize work. And it will center on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I hope, you know, that then begs the question that scientists are grappling with, which is purpose.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? And I talk about it in the power paradox at the very end, where I say, you know, it's interesting, in most cultures, we have this sense of what is your purpose in life, your unique idiosyncratic purpose. The indigenous peoples had rituals that were, you know, during your adolescent years where you went out and you felt this buzz, you know, and it sort of gave you this sense of what you're supposed to do. And I hope that we figure out economically and socially ways to give people that opportunity, right? Where it doesn't have to be. I think the estimates right now are that only about 30% of people feel like their work gives them purpose.
Right.
And the rest are pretty alienated. And so we need to work hard on that. And I think it could be a great opportunity.
Well, I think we actually don't have an option. I mean, I don't know if you've read, I mean, the two books that really did it for me were The Second Machine Age. And we had those two authors on. Cool. And they were great. And then the other one that I think is even better, all due respect to them, is Rise of the Robots by Martin Ford. And, cool. You know, what Martin Ford clarifies, the big idea, in case you don't actually want to read the book, listeners, is, and you can go talk about this at parties, you can impress people with it, you know, all you have to say, the phrase is, dude, we're reaching the end of routine work.
Yeah.
So anything that is a routine, whether that's doing accounting or, you know, putting a sprocket onto some sort of car or whatever, is going to be done by a machine. It can be much better done by a machine. And one of the most, you know, compelling points that he made in that book is he said, look at what happened at Foxconn. I mean, you know, Foxconn is this big, big company in China that makes all the iPhones. And in order to be competitive and super, super competitive, they have to have the workers sleep on site and they have to wake them up in the middle of the night to start production schedule. And the problem is that that's bad for humans. You know, we had on, his name escapes me right now, but we had on the Oxford scientist who had discovered the light receptors in the eye that are, you know, related to circadian rhythms, but not vision. And, you know, he was just saying, like, it does all these terrible things, like night shift work, night work. It's really, really bad for human health. So what happens is all these Chinese guys who are working at Foxconn, getting woken up in the middle of the night and forced to do all these sorts of things, a bunch of them commit suicide. Well, now that's really bad for all the people buying their iPhones because they feel really bad because all these people in China are committing suicide. So the point that Martin Ford makes in Rise of the Robots is, do you know who doesn't commit suicide? Do you know who works 24/7? And, you know, doesn't feel bad about it and doesn't unionize and doesn't demand rights and doesn't do all these things? Robots. And, you know, it's the same thing with all this truck stuff. I mean, you know, 90% of trucking accidents are due to human error. So there's a sort of inevitability that what you're going to end up having is that all of those jobs, all that routine work will be done by robots. Then there will be nothing for humans to do. But you're not going to let people just die and starve to death. So you're going to end up giving them some sort of guaranteed universal basic minimum income. But then they're going to be miserable because you can't sit around all day and do nothing.
Yeah, you got to work.
So they're ultimately going to switch to autonomy, mastery, purpose. And you're going to end up with the end result is an amazing culture. It's kind of the world that we've always dreamed of. Basically, cool. Marx and Adam Smith both get their way. But I think that, you know, the question is really is what is that transition like and how smooth is that transition?
Yeah.
And that really depends on, you know, how effectively can we communicate and package these ideas from self-awareness to an understanding of the nature of power to, you know, the fact that routine work is dying and will soon be gone. And that's why the problem isn't that your jobs went to China. It's that, you know, creative destruction, guys. Creative destruction.
You know, and it's so interesting, Hunter, that you talk about this because, you know, as a scientist of power, and there's a lot that good that when you have the right amount of power, a lot of good comes out of it, right? Mm-hmm. You feel good about life, you feel empowered, you feel agentic, your nervous system is healthier, mm-hmm. as I write about. And one of the things we started discovering, which really maps onto this shift in work and a kind of post-capitalist society, is people's feelings of power today don't track to obvious sources. It's not that connected to money, you know, and straight up wealth. And you know this intuitively. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do. But, you know, it's about 5-10% of the equation. It is more connected to doing important things in the world mm-hmm. that are probably independent of a paycheck. And so I think there are great opportunities of it for empowerment, right? In this kind of society freed up of drudgery and work like
but
that.
But I think it's also, I mean, one of the things that was really helpful in reading your book and then reading it side by side with Joe Hendrick's book is that, you know, I think for listeners, if you want power, right, it's really important to understand this distinction between dominance and prestige. And most people aren't clear on that distinction. And so they go about a sort of confused mix of trying to do both. And I think part of what's interesting about the reality of social media is that, you know, Trump obviously used some mix of dominance and prestige. You know, on the one hand, you know, he's got a problem because that was effective in drawing a divisive line between him and his followers and, you know, corralling them into a tribe. But at the same time, there's half of the country that he has totally alienated. And in the short term, that mix of dominance and prestige can work well. But, you know, ultimately, in order to be truly effective, you need, as you know, the broadest consensus and the broadest coalition possible. And you really need as much prestige as possible. And there are now half the country is committed to stopping him at pretty much every turn on pretty much everything that he wants to do. And by the way, I think Obama did very much the same thing. I don't think that he was doing it intentionally, but, you know, there was a mixture of prestige. But then, you know, there was dominance, and it was intellectual dominance. It wasn't bullying, but it was intellectual bullying. So it was bullying. I mean, you know, in the sense of belittling the intelligence of a lot of people and sort of making fun of them and not respecting their values. And that's a large part of what is driven bipartisanship is this mix of dominance and prestige rather than just pursuing prestige and really creating the broadest, most inclusive coalition possible.
Yeah, you know, that's such a terrific observation that, you know, you do, in stirring the passions to win elections, you do need to build networks. You need the prestige dimension, collaboration, and you need a bold, powerful message, which comes out of that has dimensions of dominance. And I think that, you know, I think we have, you know, as the kind of the education people and the pollsters and the like underestimated the appeal to this broad network of poor people, white people, that Trump appealed to. But now he's got an additional problem, which is, you know, and I grew up around these people and, you know, and now we have this incredible data that these poor whites are, their nervous systems are hurt by poverty, right? They have elevated cortisol, their brain growth is compromised. I don't know if you heard about the study showing the only group of people dying younger than their parents is poor white people in the United States. A stunning study. So what that tells us is that's the sentiment out of which this appeal emerged. And he's going to have to deliver on those promises. That's tough work.
But I think fundamentally, like his biggest problem is this, is that, you know, he's John Henry, you know, it's like John Henry and the Luddites. Like, your problem is technology. Your problem is not that the jobs went away and are going to come back. So the jobs aren't going to come back, you know.
No, they're not.
And so, A, you can't make the jobs come back. And the jobs that are actually available for these people and for all of us are knowledge work jobs. They're information age jobs. And fundamentally, you know, what you would actually have to really do in order to help people succeed in this economy is you'd have to get them to change their culture. And J.D. Vance, I mean, you know, we've been drawing a big sort of circle around four books here. You know, Richard Nisbett's Culture of Honor, J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, a book called The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, and then Black Rednecks, White Liberals by Thomas Sowell. And they're all dealing with the fact that these hillbillies have an honor culture. And they do not respect education. They do not respect book learning. And that is not an attitude that is going to serve you in the information age.
Yeah, no. No, I know. And that'll be the paradox of, you know, of his success or failure, right? Is how do you how do you lift up the welfare of those individuals when society is moving away from them?
But also
has moved away from them.
And also, how do you lift up the welfare of those individuals? You know, for a long time, Republicans have been wanting to have a conversation about culture. But they've assumed that that conversation about culture is going to come out with, oh, our culture is the best, as opposed to our culture needs to radically change. And, you know, that's not going to play well. And, you know, the Arabs are also an honor culture. And they're very proud people, you know, and they're very defensive. And, you know, if you come in and you try and tell them they have to change their culture, well, that's the fastest way to lose them. So he I mean, I think he really has a huge, huge problem on his hands. And he may be able to. I mean, you know, it's like he's a huckster. And, you know, like any huckster or snake oil salesman, you might be able to convince people that it's working. But how long can you keep that up for?
Yeah. And I think that the challenge, and I'm invested in this, is figuring out, what are the metrics by which we hold this accountable, you know? Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, are the education levels rising in poor, rural, white America? Are college graduation rates rising? Are health problems declining, like levels of obesity, which are higher in that culture, and life expectancy? If he meets those demands, then he's a legitimate politician. But I think he's got a problem.
Well, but I think that's the point, Dacher. I think here is where you need to leave your culture, because I think that's the point, is that people aren't really responsive to statistics. That's the great finding of the diffusion of innovations. They're responsive to stories.
Yeah.
And so what we need to do is that I think we need to, you know, because I don't think he's fit to rule. I don't think that he has a realistic understanding of the world. I mean, in particular, his understanding, and I've had conversations, like I had a very interesting exchange with someone on Facebook about terrorism. Because, I mean, my father works for a think tank in Dubai that is run by a Libyan man and is literally trying to figure out how do you wage a counterinsurgency. And there's firstly, the sort of the intuitions that most Republicans have about terrorism is that it's a fly and you swat it. And if you just swat all the flies, then fundamentally they're gone. But what you don't
know. No way.
That's not how it actually works. And, you know, I lived in Greece as a little kid, and my dad was the target of November 17th, which was one of the largest terrorist groups operating in Europe at the time. And then I lived in the UK for 10 years during the Northern Ireland troubles. And it's all about storytelling. And that's what people don't understand is that, and every single night, you know, one night you would get the, you know, Jerry Adams representing, you know, Sinn Féin, which was the political proxy arm of the IRA. And he would come on TV and he said, the IRA was forced to conduct this bombing in retaliation to the actions of the Protestants. We can no longer tolerate the behavior. And then he would go on all about how they made us do it. And it's really that little kid logic of they made me do it. And then the next night there'd be a bombing and, you know, the UFF had done something. And then now you would get the Reverend Ian Paisley representing the Protestants. And he would go on and he goes, this most recent bombing by the IRA has forced us to retaliate and to act in a manner that is uncharacteristic of the Protestant people. And, you know, on and on. It just goes back and forth. But everybody's sort of, it really is just like the he made me, no, he made me, you know. And what ends up happening is that when you use violence to deal with terrorism, you're just handing them a narrative.
Yeah.
And I had this great conversation on Facebook with this guy who was like, it's really simple. Trump's got a plan. He's the only man who can fix ISIS. He's going to swat him. And I said, well, you know, I hope that he respects our military enough to listen to them.
Yeah.
Isn't that a form of respect? Because there are people like John Nagel, who we've had on, who wrote the counterinsurgency manual. Uh-huh. And, you know, the fact is that, you know, this is a guy who's been on the ground. Like, I haven't served in the military. Trump hasn't served in the military. But this guy has. And he's one of our servicemen and women. And shouldn't we respect him enough to listen to him? And he was like, oh, get off your high horse, you educated liberal, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, no, I'm saying I literally know nothing about this. Like, I am utterly clueless. But I respect our military. And shouldn't we listen to him? And, you know, I don't know how effective it was. But the point is using that sort of John Haidt moral intuition stuff to like, okay, I'm going to speak to your values and let's see if, you know, you follow your values. And I think your values are right. So let me agree with you and let's listen to John Nagel and let's see what he says. And then, of course, if you get John Nagel on, he's going to say, well, no, actually, that's not a good plan.
Yeah.
But I think that's how you really like put Trump's feet over the coals. And then either he responds to that and changes or he doesn't. And then he loses his following.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And I think I only cite those statistics because those statistics about poor rural America and poor whites amount to stories of the people I grew up around,
yeah.
which is compromised lives and compromised opportunities. They're profoundly kind mm-hmm. and generous and moral, as our research has shown. But the social circumstances are not allowing them the kind of honorable, dignified lives they want.
100%.
And that's the task.
And it's the same thing with, you know, the Arabs. I mean, they're literally, but I mean, that's sort of the interesting thing that Nisbet draws out is that the aggressive use of violence and the politeness and hospitality go together. Because when you're in an environment where if you piss someone off, they might kill you, you're real genteel all the time.
Oh, yeah. you are very generous and kind.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think that's, you know, the, I think to me, I think a lot, what the moment that we're living in is that we are in the middle of a scientific reformation. Essentially, there is a huge group of people who have, you know, the Protestants are out there and they reject the authority of the scientific church.
Yeah.
And now the challenge is how quickly can we organize a counter-reformation?
Right.
And I, you know, that is what I will be advocating for. And I would love to form some sort of community of, you know, people like you and John Haidt and David Sloan Wilson and Seligman and Dweck and all that sort of stuff. I think we need to organize an effective counter-reformation, because the problem is that standing outside of science as, you know, one of the lay people, there is not a lot of doctrinal clarity. And you know, it's the failure to communicate science. I mean, I brought up the diffusion of innovations, for example, and you hadn't even heard of it. And that seems
ridiculous.
It's like a really big problem.
Yeah.
And you're not the only one, by the way. I mean, I've talked about this before on this podcast. So David Sloan Wilson, who's the big sort of multi-level selection guy.
Yeah.
So he, you know, he was concerned about the movement of ideas. And he wanted to do a conference. He wanted to do EvoCon, which, of course, is, you know, a culturally appropriate response for a scientist to come up with. You know, we're going to have a conference and it's going to be great. And it seemed a little nuts to Brian and I, because that's not really how people move ideas in sort of the average world. We were like, okay. And he sends me this 66-page paper towards evolving a science of intentional behavior change. And I read it and I was like, aren't you talking about how to move ideas? And didn't Everett Rogers already write a book on this in 1967? And he said, of course, I've heard of Everett Rogers' book, but I haven't made a close study of it. And I'm like, oh, so you never read it.
Yeah.
But he was literally about to go off and try and solve this problem that had already been solved.
Yeah. And I think this is, you know, Hunter, I think this is happening in the academy. And I think you're right. You know, we're now engaged in two different things, right?
Mm-hmm.
One is we do science.
Yeah.
And we have to solve the scientific issues in peer review and not in public writings and so forth. And sometimes intellectual debates spin out into blogs and kind of are on balance a little bit counterproductive. But we do need a society of individuals who are about the dissemination of scientific ideas, right? That have the talent to write in ways that get our ideas out in for broader public consumption.
Right.
You know, it's funny, my friend Michael Lewis, the writer, you know, he's got a book coming out on Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman, and he read all these scientific papers and he's like, you guys are so funny, you write papers so people won't read them.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. And I think it's starting to happen. And this would be a good movement to catalyze.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the other thing too, and I think something that I only realized again when I left the academy, is that it's important to realize that, you know, the once upon a time science was a startup, right?
Yeah.
And you know, it was great and it was nimble and it was all these sorts of things. And now it is a large, unwieldy bureaucracy.
It's a big bureaucracy.
Yeah. And there are, you know, the reality is that as humans, there are naturally cultural biases.
Yeah,
and
massive.
One of the big, big cultural biases is a bias towards a style of writing that does not actually move ideas and doesn't fit with what we know about how ideas move.
Yeah.
And then the other big one, I think, as well, is this tendency towards atomism. And, you know, I think that left, if a course correction isn't made, then left to its own devices, you know, and that science is very Western. That's what it comes down to. And it's sort of like, you know, these Western notions of let's pick everything apart and get smaller and smaller and smaller have been allowed to run wild. And there needs to be, I think, in the sort of perspective that I've come to is that optimism and pessimism are complementary perspectives, and the same thing is true for atomism and holism.
Yeah.
And so I think within the academy, there also needs to be some sort of role for people who are deliberate synthesizers. I mean, physics has that. So why can't we have a theory of everything human?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and you know, the great scientific advances are founded on that. You know, think about Darwin.
Yeah.
And he would write books about mollusks and the finches' beaks, and at the same time he had this holistic, synthetic, almost East Asian female way of looking at putting all these facts into a narrative.
Right.
So absolutely, I am with you 100%, and I'm going to my computer after we talk to start being more synthetic.
That sounds great. Well, I mean that's the thing that we've been doing on this podcast is we've been doing what's called mixed mental arts. Which is deliberately to be synthetic because, I mean, my sort of experience, you know, after I had my great humiliating experience of realizing that actors understood the human brain better than I did, was that, you know, I went out and I sort of essentially do you know Rule 34?
Rule 34.
Of the internet.
I don't.
So Rule 34 of the internet is if you can imagine it, there is porn of it. And I'm going to tell you that my experience is that there's sort of a corollary to Rule 34, which if you can imagine it, there is science of it. Like, literally, like, I am like, oh, you know, like, I was like, oh, how do ideas move? And then I look it up and, oh, there's Everett Rogers. That exists.
Yeah.
And in field after field after field, when you go and you just sort of apply Rule 34, you're like, yeah, somebody already studied that 5 decades ago. And, you know, nobody ever bothered to put it together.
Yeah.
So I think the time is right, and I think that one of the best things that the Academy can do between now and 2020 is to stitch together that theory of everything, because there's a good portion of the population that is, you know, still loyal to science, still has intuitions of authority about science, and with that doctrinal clarity, I mean, you know, science gives us power over reality. And if you have that clear understanding, then that's the thing that's going to allow you to beat the shit out of Trump.
And I am already getting emails from a lot of my colleagues who are very devoted to that idea. Like, how, you know, this was a humbling election, right? For the rationalist social scientist type. Like, our polls were wrong.
Right.
The election proved to be wrong. We just miscalculated and mispredicted. All of us were wrong.
Right.
So now it's time to sharpen and get clear.
And to do that counter-reformation.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, awesome. Well, everybody, the book is The Power Paradox by Dacher Keltner. It's fantastic. And Dacher, can I ask one more quick question about the book?
I'm here all day for you, Hunter.
Okay. So the other big thing is I wanted to talk about powerlessness. Which is sort of the other side of that, because what we're really talking about with this is we're talking about a set of complementary emotions. So in the same way that, you know, there's happiness and sadness, right? Which obviously Inside Out, you guys did such an amazing job of being like, oh, it turns out that sadness isn't bad. It has a social function. So in the same way, talk to us about powerlessness.
I in many ways, it was the most important part of the project of writing The Power Paradox. When you think about the abuses of power that were so interested in, there are people who lose, right? Mm-hmm. There are people who, if a boss acts disrespectfully at work and interrupts people and calls them inappropriate names, somebody's going to feel the sting of that humiliating act. If somebody hoards resources on Wall Street or builds up economic product, that someone's going to lose. And mm-hmm. so that's powerlessness. And as I dug into this and I really thought back to growing up in where I grew up in this poor rural town. And the first thing that struck me in reflecting on them, and these are people who were, a lot of them were in poverty. Their kids were not going to go to college. Some were going to end up in prison. Some would end up drug addicted. And what I noticed is their health was really compromised, right? Literally dying young. A young guy came over to our house, and he was a neighbor, and we had this rope swing. And, you know, my brother and I, we grew up in Laurel Canyon, as I said, and then we jumped off it thousands of times. He jumped off it, landed oddly, and it snapped his arm in half.
Right? Wow.
Yeah, and we now know that's called child frailty syndrome, where your bones don't grow effectively. And we know this whole health profile, one of the most direct causes of it is feeling powerlessness, right? It's just feeling like you don't contribute to society. You don't have dignified work. I loved your terms earlier, Hunter. And I got, when I started to think back on my life and consult this new science, it led to this chapter on when we do not feel like we can contribute. And then when we feel, think about it, the relevance today, disrespected mm-hmm. by those in power because of our class identity or gender identity, it activates regions of your nervous system, cortisol, the inflammation response, that are fundamentally in human social life about powerlessness. Mm-hmm. And it's really bad news, right? It is the central cause of our health problems today and why our healthcare system is underperforming. So to me, that's the central reason I wrote the book. And I think it speaks a lot to today's politics.
Yeah. And so powerlessness, I mean, because I think part of what I got from Inside Out is that, you know, all of these, and, you know, we also, we had Jennifer Jacquette on as well. Is shame necessary? And, yeah. you know, what emerges from looking at all of this is that you come to realize that all of these emotions have a function, a socially constructive function. But the question is, are they applied appropriately? And right. are you getting a mix of them? So the point right. is that it's not that powerlessness is necessarily bad. It's right. that sitting in powerlessness for decades and decades and having that be your only emotional experience is terrible.
It is. And, you know, being submissive and modest and humble is great in the right context.
Yeah.
Right. And you show your deference to somebody and respect, but then you move on to the next context. But the people that I grew up around, you know, we're in this little town, 9 houses on a rural road, and that's where they were going to live. That's where their kids were going to live. The schools weren't changing. Mm-hmm. They were only getting worse. And so it's this chronic powerlessness. And you know, the studies are just amazing. Like, you can have a nice title in an organization,
yeah.
right? But if you chronically don't feel like you're contributing and have power, you show the same health profile,
right?
Your high cortisol, inflammation stuff. And it starts to seep into how you look at the world, the innovation you have in your work. So it's one of the most important reminders of the privilege of power is there are people around you who you could really cost in terms of their well-being.
Right.
And that's a humble reminder of sticking close to good power.
And it's because I think that's the thing. Part of what becomes difficult with all of this as well is terminology. I think that one of the most interesting things that I came to realize is in reading John Haidt's book, The Happiness Hypothesis, like that was actually very upsetting to a narrative that I had picked up about science at Harvard and in the biochemistry department, which is essentially that, you know, everything before me was, you know, wicked, foolish, stupid superstition. And then along came science. And lo, there was light in the West.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in reality, you come to find that, you know, as a kid, I thought that science was about making theories. And I now understand that it's about breaking theories.
Yeah.
The human mind has no problem making theories. Look at the internet. It's full of conspiracy theories and theories about whether Jon Snow is dead. Like, humans do that naturally. It's that process of really breaking theories. And the interesting thing is that the reason why Jesus and the Buddha and Ben Franklin and all of these guys did so well in understanding human thinking is because they had the tools to do that. They could watch their own brain at work. And it's only when you have better tools that you can now ask even questions about bacteria. Like, you need a microscope to ask that, and you need a telescope to ask questions about the stars. So a lot of this is about, you know, whether you have the tools or not. But essentially, you know, it's been this one sort of long cultural evolutionary thread of making better and better and better theories over time. But, you know, the tools have empowered that. And part of that is the scientific method. And part of that is just glass making technology. But, you know, understanding, I think that's a really important thing for people to understand is that you can't, you know, you sitting wherever you're sitting in the world can't really test theories easily about quasars. You don't have your own Hubble Space Telescope. But everything that we're talking about here, you can test.
Yeah.
Because you can watch your own brain at work. You can see what your brain does.
Absolutely.
And then you can be like, oh, that's actually a good fit for how my brain actually works. Oh, wait, that is interesting. So I think, because I think what's part of what's so, because part of what was so important about this experience of teaching at a school that taught creationism is that because I couldn't rely on the authority of science, I had to be like, ugh, what is, like, how is this practically useful to you? Because he was like, why do we care where fish came from? And I was kind of like, okay, I kind of get your point. And, you know, and he didn't have, like, some massive fossil record we could look online, but it's the internet. Like, can you really trust anything on the internet? You know, what's to say this isn't made up? So I had to, like, really think about, okay, what can you confirm as a scientist with your own eyes? And The all of this stuff on cultural evolution is really, really powerful. Like, that's, you know, deeply personally relevant. And all of this stuff about how humans actually think, you know, in terms of what power does to people's brains and all that sort of stuff. That those are the sorts of ideas that are set up to move as we go forward as scientific missionaries, because it's like that has deep personal relevance. I can watch it in my own brain. I can see it in people around me. And I'm like, oh, that's a useful tool. I'll take that.
And, you know, I mean, it's so, this is such a great conversation, Hunter, and I love your riffs on this. I mean, great science is founded in that humble, clear-eyed examination of things, like you're talking about, where you put away your biases and your arrogance. It's also founded, as you've been championing today, in deep intuition, right? And we often dismiss intuition, but I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, one is, of course, Darwin, who was blown away by the beauty of natural patterns. And he had to explain that scientifically. And that led to his theory of evolution. That was an intuitive response to nature and natural patterns. It's interesting, you know, the we learned a lot in physics by trying to make sense of what rainbows are, right? And there's this wonderful book by Harvard professor Fisher on how Newton and Descartes and others struggled with making sense of why do we perceive the patterns of color in a rainbow. And that led to scientific discovery, but it emerged out of emotion and intuition. Like, this is so beautiful. Let me make sense of it. And I hope in this reformation of science, we stay close to the appreciation of the beauty of human nature and keep at it, understanding what that is.
Well, on that note, and, you know, I think that's the thing. I think that if we have to win, if we're going to win hearts and minds, I think we have to. Because ultimately, and, you know, I think that's the thing is that for the problem with sort of rationalism is that you ignore large parts of the soul. Whether you want to talk about the soul or whether you want to talk about the, you know, your affective systems or whatever you want to call it, right? There are large parts of human nature. You know, man cannot live by bread alone. And we need this diversity of emotions. We need sadness. We need powerlessness, but we also need power, and we need joy, and we need a full range of experiences. And I think the science that you are help shaping, and the science that we as a community are going to help shape out of this Counter-Reformation, is going to be a science that speaks to every part of the human condition. And it's going to be the best science that there's ever been. We're going to have all the best science.
I'm going back to the lab. I feel inspired.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Well, Dacher Keltner, you know, I think your book could not be more timely. I strongly enjoyed it, and I think everybody should read it. And you couldn't have really come on at a better time, because I think the long arc of history is long, and often there are perturbations in it. But in the end, I think that, you know, we're going to end up at, you know, a society that really sort of values people who win power and don't bully.
All right. I'm with you, Hunter.
Thank you so much.
It's great talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you. And you're always welcome on the show.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Dacher Keltner. Always a gem. Follow him on Twitter. You know, he's really, he is a light in the world, and we should have more of him. And that's why, you know, I'm hoping that human cloning is going to come along. No, one Dacher Keltner is good. One Dacher Keltner is good. We wouldn't want there to be facsimiles. So thanks so much for listening. Also, there's a blog now, mixedmentalarts.club. Check that out. And I really appreciate all the feedback you guys have been giving me. You know, slowly but surely, we will figure out better and better ways to move these ideas and turn them all to cat videos so that everybody can watch it. Like, how can we express the ideas of the power of it paradox through cats? That's a challenge for the community. And really, I hope it is a community. If you guys have any ideas, just let me know. And really, I'm just trying to facilitate all of this. So let me know if you have stuff you want to throw in, if you want to contribute, if you want to create your own memes, if you want to create your own articles. Just let me know. I'm always available on Twitter at Hunter Mods. Thanks a lot, guys.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.